Hello, folks. This is the Illinois World Labor Hour, and sorry about that. Some reason our CD player kept wanting to start the theme song over again.
It was a good
again.
Song. They had to keep playing it.
Well, I guess so, but it was a little redundant. Anyway, yes, you are listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour broadcast on WEFT Radio, broadcasting from downtown Champaign at 90.1 FM and webcasting worldwide at www.weft.org.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, we're going to be having sort of an interesting show today. Thursday was September 11th, and it's the anniversary. There is actually two September 11ths most people are not aware of. Of course, most are aware of the September 11th, 2001 anniversary of when the two World Trade Center buildings in the Pentagon were hit by terrorists. And also there's the September 11th, 1973 Chilean military coup that was backed by the CIA. Both events were very horrific to each country. Lots of people were killed. In the case of Chile, even worse things happened. So stay tuned. We're going to be talking about both of those events and how they had an effect on both democracy and workers. And now we will go to the headlines with Tom Thomas.
California's influential prison guards union is pursuing a recall election against Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger because it has lost faith in his leadership abilities during one of the longest budget impasses in California history. Schwarzenegger officials said that the recall attempt was an intimidation tactic employed by the union, the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, to force the governor to raise wages for its 31,000 members. The union says the recall effort is about the governor's overall leadership style and credibility rather than any individual issues such as salary negotiations. Recall efforts have been common in California since Ronald Reagan was the governor, but the only one to gather enough signatures to hold a special election was that against Gray Davis, whom Schwarzenegger replaced in 2003. Political observers in California are estimating it would cost from $3 to $5 million to collect the roughly 1 million signatures necessary to force an election, and the election itself could double that cost. A spokesman for the union, Lance Corcoran, said that they had $10 million in a political action fund and that it would try to form a coalition of like-minded groups and individuals to contribute to the recall campaign. After months of political assaults from Republicans over high gasoline prices, House Democrats are promoting legislation that would relax a decades-old ban on oil drilling along much of the nation's coastline. The legislation, still being assembled last week, would also require utility companies to generate more power from renewable sources, provide tax incentives for alternative energy like wind power, and institute new conservation programs. The measure, which would retain current restrictions on drilling off the Gulf Coast of Florida, would repeal some federal subsidies for oil companies and seek to improve the collection of royalty payments from petroleum producers. The proposal, coming as the Senate develops a similar plan, represents a stark reversal for Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who had adamantly opposed a vote on an expansion of offshore drilling after being part of the coalition that has kept the coastal ban in place since the 1980s. From another perspective, the prospect of relaxing the restrictions is drawing strong opposition from the environmental community, which argues that offshore drilling will do absolutely nothing to reduce oil prices, and the Congress should instead be focusing on encouraging greater reliance on various forms of natural and alternative energy. The Department of Homeland Security said last week that cost overruns, legal obstacles, and other problems were endangering its goal of completing some 670 miles of fencing and technological improvements on the southwestern border of the United States. Rising costs for construction and materials and delays in acquiring land from owners could foil the effort to build the fence by the end of the year, and officials are now requesting more money for the inane project. The department has 341 miles of new fencing already in place along the 2,000-mile border with Mexico, but completing their project hinges on the redirection of $400 million in department funds. Since 2005, Congress has appropriated over $2.7 billion for the Secure Border Initiative, a combination of physical barriers and so-called virtual fence, a system of cameras and sensors. The Government Accountability Office, an investigative arm of Congress, said last week that the Homeland Security Department had no projections for the total cost in building and maintaining the fence, so there will very likely be many millions, if not billions, of dollars more of our tax dollars gone to another wholly corrupt government institution. And finally, Iowa's Attorney General has brought an array of criminal charges for child labor violations against the owners and top managers of a meatpacking plant located in Postville, where nearly 400 workers were detained in an immigration raid last May. The state charges were first to be brought against the owners and managers of Agri-Processors, Inc. in Postville since the May 12th raid. Federal prosecutors have already convicted nearly 400 workers, most of them from Guatemala, on document fraud charges, with the majority of them sentenced to 5 months in lockup. Advocates for the immigrants had criticized the federal prosecutors for punishing the workers, yet doing nothing at all to prosecute or convict the owners and managers. In all, 9,311 criminal misdemeanor charges involving 32 underage workers were filed against the company and its owner, Aaron Rubashkin, and his son, Shalom, who was the top manager of the Postville plant. Many workers, including some who were even under 16, worked on machinery prohibited for employees under 18 years of age, including conveyor belts, meat grinders, circular saws, power washers, and power shears. Under Iowa law, employing a worker under 18 on the floor of a slaughterhouse is a criminal misdemeanor with a maximum punishment of 30 days in jail and a fine of $625. But the charges were multiplied to over 9,000 times because a new one was brought for each day and each offense. If convicted, the Rubashkins are facing more than $5 million in fines and significant prison terms. Dave?
In a related story, the leading Jewish authority in charge of certifying kosher food has threatened to withdraw its certification from the products of Agri-Processors Incorporated, the nation's largest kosher meat packer, after criminal charges for more than 9,000 child labor violations that Tom mentioned were brought against this company and its owners in Iowa this week. Rabbi Menachem Ganach, who was in charge of kosher supervision for the Orthodox Union, the major kosher certifying organization in the United States, said that he had set a deadline of several weeks for Agri-Processors to name a new chief executive, or the group would suspend supervision of kosher production at its plants. Because of new charges in the state of Iowa, we believe it is the best interest of the kosher consuming public to have new management with a new CEO that will give people a new sense of confidence that all laws and regulations are being completely complied with, Rabbi Ganachin said in an interview on Wednesday. Losing the kosher certification, the Orthodox Union would be potentially crippling blow to Agri-Processors, whose meat and poultry sold as Aaron's Best and Rubashkin's, among other brands, are staples in Jewish households nationwide that observe kosher practices. The company is by far the largest producer of kosher meat, with annual kosher sales estimate $80 million. Although other groups provide certification, they are less widely known, and the loss of the familiar circled U seal on the company's products could drive away many consumers.
Yes, Dave, and another related story, a Swift meatpacking plant in Greeley, Colorado this week laid off or fired over 100 workers. According to the union, it was more than 150 workers, and they were Somalia workers, and the reason they were fired was because they wanted to pray. It's Ramadan, and they need one of their rules is to pray at sundown, and the factory said you could take your break at 9 o'clock at night, and that wasn't really sundown for these folks.
Mm-hmm.
That same factory actually had fired 450 Hispanic workers back in 2005.
Well, it seems like a lot of interesting news lately in the meatpacking industry.
Yes.
You know, there's a interesting history of the meatpacking. I mean, basically, up until the early, mid-1980s, meatpacking mostly we unionized and paid decent wages, but after the big loss at P9 Hormel in Austin, Minnesota, that strike, which, by the way, was sold out by the International Union, and they basically put P9 Local in Austin, Minnesota, in trusteeship, to force them to take this horrible contract that the industry wanted them to accept. I just read a book recently called Organizing Wall to Wall, which is a little history about how the meatpacking plants in Austin, Minnesota, and the surrounding area of southern Minnesota, northern Iowa, were originally organized back in the 1930s, early 30s, for that matter, and quite an interesting little history there. But anyway, one last story here. We have last month in August marked the 61st anniversary of the Taft-Hartley Act, one of the greatest blows to American democracy that went into effect. The act, which was drafted by employers, fundamentally infringed on workers' human rights. Legally, Taft-Hartley impeded employees to join together in unions, undermined the ability of unions to represent workers' interests effectively, and authorized an array of anti-union activities by employers. Among its key provisions, Taft-Hartley authorized states to enact so-called right-to-work laws. These laws undermine the ability to build effective unions by creating a free rider problem where workers enjoy the benefits of union membership without actually joining the union or paying union dues. It also outlawed the closed shop, which required that persons join the union before being eligible for employment with a unionized employer. Still permit our provisions that require any member of a bargaining unit to pay a portion of dues to that union, though not to join the union. Also, it defined employee, quote-unquote, for purposes of the act as excluding supervisors and independent contractors. And this diminished the pool of workers eligible to be unionized. And it also permitted employers to petition for a union certification election, thus undermining the ability of workers and unions to control the timing of an election during the sensitive organizing stage, forcing election before the union is ready, and required that the employer be able to demand hearings on key matters of dispute, such as what constitutes an appropriate bargaining unit, before a union recognition election, thus delaying the election. Delay generally benefits management, giving the employer time to coerce or fire pro-union workers. It establishes the quote-unquote right of management to campaign against union organizing drive, thereby scuttling the principle of employer neutrality. And the big one, it prohibited secondary boycotts. Boycotts directed to encourage neutral employers to pressure the employer with which the union is having a dispute. Prior to 1947, secondary boycotts had been one of organized labor's most potent tools for organizing, negotiating, and dispute settlement. The political damage of Taft-Hartley was just as severe, in addition to starting an era of red-baiting with the American labor movement, which led to harmful internal divisions. The act sent a message to employers that it was okay to bust unions and deny workers the right to collective bargaining. In short, Taft-Hartley entrenched significant executive tyranny in the corporate workplace, with ramifications that are more severe today than ever. Union membership is at a historic 60-year low, with only 8% of the private economy's workforce unionized. That figure is slightly higher for public sector workers. Employer violations of labor rights are routine, and illegal firings of union supporters and labor organizing drives are at epidemic levels. And this comes from a story about Ralph Nader slams 1947 anti-union law. And Ralph Nader is the only presidential candidate so far that's come out and advocated the repeal of this horrible anti-union legislation.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Day 4 of the Boeing strike begins today over job security, benefits, and pay. The International Association of Machinists represents the 27,000 striking workers. No talks have been scheduled as of this morning, and no one is sure how long the strike could last. Previous contract strikes by Boeing workers have ranged from 28 to 68 days. As a result of this strike, some Boeing parts suppliers have begun cutting back on production and hours at their own plants. For example, Spirit AeroSystems has shortened their work week. Despite the loss of the high auto industry wage standard forged by the UAW over decades of struggle, a rank-and-file Flint, Michigan auto worker sees reason to hope. Doug Cunningham reports.
Dean Braid hails from Flint, where workers took on the world's biggest corporation and won union recognition the hard way by occupying a factory. He's not happy watching worker gains won through immense struggle and confrontation slip away for the next generation of auto workers.
Our UAW took the wrong direction over 25 years ago when it decided to get closer with management and start cooperating. With that, we saw the demise of the UAW. The many things that our forefathers won with wages, benefits, working conditions have all deteriorated since then.
Braid, though, still has hope for a better future for auto workers, a future won once again through struggle and solidarity forever.
I think that you're going to see members, after they start breaking down physically, that they'll start pushing for higher wages, and I think it'll be a galvanizing tool to bring their wages up. And I've got a lot of confidence in younger workers that are coming into the workforce. When we reflect back on our history to see what worked, solidarity is the answer. Solidarity is what really does win in these sort of situations.
Work continues at a Mitsubishi plant in Normal, Illinois. The workers at the plant rejected the company's most recent contract offer and have voted to authorize a strike. The previous contract expired on Friday. More than 1,000 workers are employed at the plant. Here is today's economic report. The summer of 2008 will go down as the worst summer for job cuts in 6 years. Cuts leapt by 12% over the summer of 2007. A total of 377,325 jobs were cut between May and August, an increase of 128,128 over 2007. Overall job cuts from the first 8 months of 2008 are up 29% over the first 8 months of 2007.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers can notch another win for workers on their tomato buckets. On Tuesday, the coalition announced Whole Foods Market had signed onto the coalition's penny per pound program, where major food purchasers would pay an extra penny for Florida-grown tomatoes. The idea is that those extra pennies would be passed on to the tomato pickers. In a joint statement with the coalition, Whole Foods Global Produce Coordinator Karen Christensen said the company made the decision after evaluating the situation in Florida. The plan fits with the company's core values. The coalition has had multiple successes in applying pressure on tomato purchasers. Both Taco Bell and McDonald's have signed agreements similar to the one forged with Whole Foods. Iowa's agriprocessors has been slammed with 9,311 charges of labor law violations. Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller filed the criminal charges against the company's owner and four managers. According to the affidavit filed in court on Tuesday, all of the named individual defendants possess shared knowledge that agriprocessors employed undocumented aliens. It was likewise shared knowledge among the defendants that many of those workers were minors. 32 workers were under the age of 18, and 7 were under the age of 16. The document also alleges that the defendants encouraged workers to file false identification. Each violation carries a punishment of up to 30 days in jail and fines ranging from $65 to $625. The Pottsville, Iowa plant is the leading kosher meat packing plant in the country and was raided on May 12th. The plant managers are scheduled to appear in court today. More layoffs for Ford and GM, but this time the job cuts are coming from across the pond. Overall, 1,900 workers are likely to be let go by the two companies' plants in Spain. Ford says it plans to temporarily lay off between 1,000 and 1,200 workers due to anemic demand. GM plans to slash 600 jobs. Spain has seen a drop in new car registrations of 21% over the first 8 months of 2008. Here is today's economic report. The workplace environment.
Okay, we're going to let Bob Plesney give a little bit of the economic report here.
Yeah, Dave. Statistics announced this week, jobless claims dropped slightly. New applications for unemployment benefits fell less than expected last week, the U.S. government said Thursday, as the struggling economy continues to take a toll on workers. The trade deficit, meanwhile, surged to a 16-month high in July as oil prices hit record levels. The Labor Department reported that applications for jobless benefits dropped to a seasonally adjusted 445,000, down by 6,000 from the prior week. That is above the analysts' expectations of 440,000. The four-week moving average, which smooths out week-to-week fluctuations, rose slightly to 440,000. Economists consider jobless claims above 400,000 an indicator of a slowing economy. A year ago, initial claims stood at 322,000. The Commerce Department said the gap between imports and exports rose 5.7% to $62.2 billion, much worse than the $58.8 billion Wall Street economists expected. And the number of people continuing to draw jobless benefits also increased, rising $122,000 to $353 million, above analysts' expectations and the highest in almost 5 years. The four-week average rose to $343.43 million. And last week's statistics, again, the U.S. unemployment rate unexpectedly shot up to 6.1% in August, its highest in nearly 5 years, as employers cut payrolls for an eighth straight month and labor markets showed signs of accelerating decline. It says that 84,000 jobs were lost in August, significantly higher than the 75,000 economists surveyed by Reuters had forecast. And there were steep cuts in hiring in nearly every major category of employment. Some 61,000 manufacturing jobs were lost in August, the most for any month since mid-2003, and 8,000 more construction jobs were cut. There were 53,000 jobs eliminated in professional and business services and 4,000 in leisure and hospitality industries.
Okay, we're back. And our program today. First of all, I'd like to mention that the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. You are listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour, broadcasting from downtown Champaign on 90.1 FM and webcasting worldwide at www.weft. Well, as everyone knows, this, two days ago, Thursday, was September 11th, and we mentioned earlier in the show there's actually two noted dates of September 11th. The one that most people are aware of, the September 11th, 2001, in which there was attack on the Pentagon and in the Trade Center, World Trade Center in New York City. And there's one that a lot of people, most people, in fact, I would say, in this country are not at all aware of, and that's the September 11th, 1973 attack, so to speak, in Chile. Thanks to the corporate media, September 11th has now become synonymous with the so-called war against terrorism and the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The United States government, however, does not want to be reminded of certain events that took place in its backyard on the same date 35 years ago. Chilean President Salvador Allende, the first democratically elected socialist leader in Latin America, was overthrown in a bloody coup by sections of the Chilean armed forces on September 11th, 1973. The coup was financed and organized by American intelligence agencies in tandem with right-wing sectors of Chilean society. President Salvador Allende was murdered by the military after they captured control of the presidential palace. Documents released in the U.S. have now revealed that the Central Intelligence Agency had funded in millions of dollars to right-wing groups to carry out their terrorist attacks against the democratically elected government. The then U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger had famously said that Chile should not be allowed to, quote, go Marxist just because its people were irresponsible in voting. In Chile, before the coup, the Allende government had announced its intentions to implement land and economic reforms. The monopoly of U.S. multinationals over key resources was challenged. If the democratic revolution had been allowed to succeed, it would have had tremendous impact over the rest of Latin America. General Augusto Pinochet, who was handpicked by the Nixon administration to run the country, was about to open the most brutal chapter in Chilean history with a coup against a democratically elected government. The CIA provided the Chilean secret police under Pinochet with the names of so-called leftist subversives and even American sympathizers of the Allende government based in the country. Many of those identified by the CIA joined the ranks of the thousands of the missing, including American citizens Charles Horman and Frank Tarugi, from whom a Hollywood film was made called Missing with Sissy Spacek and Jack Lemmon. At minimum, 4,000 Chileans were killed by the notorious secret police, the DINA, in Chile during and after the coup. Another 70,000 were tortured. Hundreds of thousands were exiled. The U.S. Embassy in the Chilean capital, Santiago, was aware of the goings-on. The main football stadium in the capital was turned into a temporary concentration camp and torture center. Hundreds of people were shot dead with machine guns in the stadium itself. Pinochet went on to rule for 17 years by enacting dictatorial draconian laws. In the 1970s, the Chilean government and the military dictatorships in Argentina and Bolivia cooperated with the CIA in Operation Condor, a dirty war which involved thousands of cases of torture and disappearances throughout Latin America. Political opponents were targeted for assassinations in third countries. Among the most famous cases was that of Orlando Letelier, Chile's ambassador to Washington during the Allende years. Letelier was in exile in the United States. He was assassinated in a car bomb explosion with his American secretary, Ronnie Moffitt, on a busy Washington, D.C. street in 1976. The guilty have not yet been brought to trial. It is alleged that the CIA had a role in the murder of Letelier and Moffitt. Despite the formal return to democracy in 1990, only a few of those people responsible for the atrocities have been brought to justice. Even the 40 Chilean military officials who had been convicted so far have got off lightly because of loopholes put in place in the laws by the military dictatorship before the transition to democracy. Chile's electoral laws, a legacy of the dictatorship, have seen to it that right-wing parties have a decisive say in politics. Every constituency elects two members to parliament, making it easy for right-wing candidates to sneak into parliament on the strength of minority votes. It was the House of Rest of Augusto Pinochet in London in 1998 that gave a flip to the movement and to bring those responsible for September 11, 1973 to justice. Most of the establishment parties in Chile had entered into an unwritten agreement with the military not to rock the boat, quote unquote. Unfortunately, even the Socialist Party, which was once headed by Allende, had become part of the establishment bandwagon. The so-called socialists, who had now returned to power, the head of a center-left coalition, have had to make a lot of compromises to do so. Allende's progressive ideology had been replaced by adherence to corporate globalism. The party has, in fact, continued with free market economic policies initiated by the Pinochet regime. The richest 10% of Chileans monopolize 50.3% of the country's national income. The poorest 10% account for barely 3.7%. So, in fact, because of the neocons' agenda that was begun with the bloody murderous coup in Chile, continues. If you'd like some more background information about Chile and how the coup had influenced other governments around the world as far as ramming through their economic policies through various tactics of what's been called shock doctrine, you can read, I recommend that you read Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. One last little note here about Chile, 1973. As many of the bodies of those who have disappeared have not been found, those responsible for their abduction can still be prosecuted by recent Chilean court rulings. Such people will not be covered in the general amnesty during the last days of Pinochet dictatorship. In recent years, Chilean prosecutors have called on people like Henry Kissinger to give evidence. Kissinger has refused to oblige them. In fact, Kissinger is also not taking any chances these days while embarking on his frequent money-making jaunts to foreign lands. He travels abroad only after seeking legal advice. Obviously, Kissinger does not want to have the kind of experience Pinochet had in London when he was placed under house arrest. In fact, Kissinger cannot travel to any European Union country, nor most Latin American countries.
There are warrants for his arrest.
Indeed. Well, there's a Spanish judge who has issued a warrant for his arrest for questioning as a hostile witness. And since Spain is a member of the European Union, any country that's in the European Union, which is most of Western Europe now and even Eastern Europe, have to detain him to be brought before the Spanish judge.
Too bad we couldn't detain him 20 years ago.
Yeah. Although some of U.S. government documents relating to the September 11, 1973 Chilean military coup have been declassified, most of the documents about Chile that pertain to 35 years ago are still classified. Why? Why are these documents still classified after 35 years?
Because the bad guy don't want us to know the truth.
I think that's an interesting question we need to ask. And believe me, this what I think is interesting. I mean, first of all, I mean, this coup in Chile was devastating for the working class. There was a school of neocon economists based out of the University of Chicago called the Chicago School, or Chicago Boys. Milton Friedman was their main guru. They're the ones, right after the military coup, went down to Chile and basically were put in place as ministers of the economy, economic ministers, and they basically started this entire free market economy. Basically, Social Security was entirely privatized. All job protections were eliminated. I mean, it was just devastating. Devastating to the Chilean working class.
And of course, you won't find a union there.
Well, that's the thing. All the unions were destroyed, and then phony company unions were set up that were under the firm thumb of the military dictatorship. But what's interesting, this coup in Chile then had an influence on the military coming to power in Argentina just a couple years later. Bolivia followed suit. Of course, Paraguay was another notorious military dictatorship, had already been in power since the late 40s under Stroessner, I think his name was. A very brutal dictatorship. But now we've seen the news that Latin America has finally, over the last several years, begun to, it's been going on now for about 10 years where they've actually come back to democracy and then some. I mean, it seems like most of the governments in South America, in particular of Latin America, have really started to reject this whole neoliberal corporate economic agenda and are starting to actually implement policies to help the majority of their people, especially
Hugo
the poor.
Chavez is a very good example.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Likewise, Morales in Bolivia and Carrera in Ecuador, who, by the way, Carrera used to teach here at the University of Illinois up until just recently as a professor.
That.
Yes. Yes, and the policies they're implementing in most of these countries in South America right now are the exact same policies that Allende tried to implement when he was elected to the president and was overthrown and murdered as a result.
And Dave, I'd also like to recommend that movie you mentioned in that article, Missing.
Yes.
I recall seeing that about 15 years ago.
Yeah, it came out in the 80s, actually.
Yeah, uh-huh. Those scenes of that football stadium with those people in there getting rounded up and tortured, those scenes were very gripping.
And just the whole story, and this is all based on a true story about
that really happened.
The father and the wife of the guy, Charles Horman, the whole movie's about them searching for him and not knowing if he's alive or dead, and then finally finding out the worst. And what was really revealing is how it was that the Chilean government, the military government, dared to kill any Americans, considering the CIA helped finance them. And the movie does answer that question.
Two mighty towers filled with life reached up to touch the autumn sky, each sparkling against the blue, each filled with thousands who would die. Two great steel birds were sent to crash into the buildings glittering, and that is why upon this day we who remember are weeping. And they who knocked the towers down are still in power in our land, and most treacheries worldwide are products of their fascist band. When will they pay for what they did? Why are they not in jail right now? How long must we who once were free continue to scrape and to bow? Retard Bush is not the only war criminal who's turned on us. There are many who pull his strings, enough to make an angel cuss. To pluck the weeds from government, we as a people need to do, because it is the only way World War III can ever be through. No more planes will fall from the sky. No more innocents will have to die. No more will suffer from Bush's lies when world unity is nigh. 9/11 was a warning to we with eyes that still can see. Our enemies are here at home in a place called Washington, D.C. September 11th, 2008 was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on September 11th, 2008 and was first broadcast live on the Illinois World Labor Hour on September 13th, 2008 on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thank you. another unknown soldier. Another lesson learned. Kick the gas can over. Strike a match, get back and watch that sucker burn. Smiling for the camera. Keep waving to the crowd. Don't let up for an instant. Stay the course and make your mama proud. You're the man. Show 'em what you're made of. You know. They're all afraid of, but you're only Cheney's toy. Another unknown soldier who's seen it all before. All in the name of Jesus.
Okay, that was Cheney Toy by James McMurtry, which brings us, by the way, you're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM, the Illinois World Labor Hour. This comes to the next part of our program about the other 9/11, the 9/11 that most people are aware of, which was the attack on New York and New York City, the World Trade Center towers in New York City, and the Pentagon in Washington D.C. And there's been a lot of controversy about September 11th, 2001. It was quite a shocking event, and you know, and to anyone who's passed through the last 8 years believing whatever George W. Bush says and his minions. Have blown their way. Well, best of luck to you, because most of it hasn't been true. And with that premise, it is amazing how a lot of people in this country still believe a lot of the accounts, if you will, of what actually happened on 9/11 coming out of the Bush administration. No matter what you believe, the fact is there's a lot of unanswered questions about what happened on 9/11 that didn't even get covered in the official Hamilton Keene 9/11 report. Bob, what are some of the, I mean, there's a lot of things that people assume that aren't necessarily true. I mean, for instance, one thing I know is that there was never any forensic evidence taken from the site of the World Trade Center towers or the Pentagon, for that matter, and studied, which is usually what happens in any kind of a criminal happening, you know, any kind of criminal investigation. What are some other things that a lot of people have, let's put it this way, some have been wondering about? There's some unanswered questions.
I have this card here, Dave, that has 11 remarkable facts about 9/11.
Okay.
And number one on their list was the mysterious collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. And
so that was a third building besides the two.
A third building, yeah. A 47-story steel frame skyscraper located one block from the Twin Towers was not hit by any plane, but collapsed at 5:20 that evening, imploding in the exact manner of a professionally engineered demolition. It fell suddenly straight down at near freefall speed and landed in a compact pile of rubble, barely damaging any of the surrounding buildings. And Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder of the three buildings, said in 2002 on a PBS documentary that the afternoon of 9/11, he suggested to the New York City Fire Department commander that they pull the building, and pull is an industry term that means demolish. But it normally takes a team of skilled people many weeks to design and implement large demolitions. Astonishingly, there is no mention of World Trade Center Building 7 remarkable collapse in the 571-page 9/11 Commission report.
Yeah, what a coincidence.
Yeah, and like Dave says, you know, the World Trade Center steel, if fully examined, could have revealed the effects of explosives, and it was quickly shipped overseas and melted down.
Or disproved. You know, it could either prove or disprove that there was actually explosives used in the building.
They also talk about whenever contact is lost with any airplane, fighter jets routinely take to the air to investigate, and this commonly occurs about 100 times a year in well under 20 minutes. But on 9/11, nearly 2 hours passed without any interceptions. Yeah,
and that was four planes that morning.
Right. The Secret Service broke established protocols by allowing President Bush to remain in a well-publicized classroom photo op long after it was known that the U.S. was under attack and he might well have been a target.
Oh, yes, whispered in his ear, that's whatever was whispered, kept reading the story of the pet goat.
Yeah.
There's a film footage of that, I think, from Florida Public Television that people can Google and get on the Internet.
Also, they say there were warnings of impending attacks from at least 11 other countries. Also, prior to 9/11, insiders such as John Ashcroft, top military officers, and San Francisco Willie Brown were warned not to fly.
And that was when? About a month or so before?
It just says prior to 9/11, insider. But yeah, I think John Ashcroft quit flying commercial about a month before the attacks.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. In September of 2000, a group of neocon hawks, many of whom would become key officials in the Bush administration, I know one was Paul Wolfowitz, wrote that their proposed massive military buildup would proceed slowly, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor.
And this was a year before 9/11 in 2000?
September of 2000, before Bush was even in office and stuff, the Jersey girls, we discussed them a little bit yesterday, Dave. Mm-hmm. Four courageous 9/11 widows finally forced the 9/11 Commission into existence and presented many questions, most of which were ignored. Under the leadership of Bush administration insider Philip Zelikow, the final report failed to address any of the evidence pointing to official complicity. And that report, as we said, the Bush administration resisted the formation of the 9/11 Commission for 441 days.
That's a year and a quarter. I mean, that's about a year and 15 months.
Similar investigations, such as those for Pearl Harbor, the JFK assassination, and the space shuttle disasters, all started in about 1 week.
That's interesting.
And one of the other facts we discussed a little bit yesterday too, Dave, that fire has never, prior to or after 9/11, caused any steel frame building to collapse. The sudden vertical explosive and total collapses of the Twin Towers at near free fall speed can only be explained by controlled demolition.
Implosion.
Yes. And it says there are hundreds of additional facts. And they recommend that you go to www.911truth.org as one of the many websites to go to find out some of these facts.
Okay. Yeah, this is a very emotional issue, and it's really interesting because this is it cuts across all established political categories, if you will. I mean, in the one corner, there are the official report backers, including not only Bush and company and their sycophants, but a mod of Bush bashers, including such well-regarded lefties as Professor Noam Chomsky, journalist Greg Palast, satirist Bill Maher, columnist Alexander Coburn, and the comedy team Penn and Teller, who think that the 9/11 official report was right on the money and there needs to be no further questions asked about what happened on 9/11. On the other side of the ledge, though, has boasts its own raft of notables calling for a new independent investigation into the attacks of 9/11. These include former U.S. Senators Lincoln Chafee and Mike Gravel, current politicians Ron Paul, former governor of Minnesota Jesse Ventura, current congressman of Ohio Dennis Kucinich, historian Howard Zinn, filmmaker Michael Moore, actors Martin and Charlie Sheen, Ed Asner and Rosie O'Donnell, as well as, this was a real surprise, I never heard this one before, former UN Chief Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, and retired CIA chairman of the National Intelligence Estimates, Ray McGovern. All those people think that there needs to be a new 9/11 investigation with a truly independent panel of investigators. It's interesting, too. Richard Gage is a San Francisco Bay Area-based architect and the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He presently has over 400 fellow architects and engineers who have signed on with him, demanding a new investigation. Gage contends that the World Trade Center Twin Towers came down as a result of controlled demolitions, citing the 10,000-page National Institute of Standards and Technology report, which happens to be an official office of the U.S. Bush-controlled Commerce Department. The NIST 2005 report on the tower collapses. Gage notes that the report stops before the collapse as far as their scenarios. Why? Gage charges if they had gone any further in their analysis, they would have to account for the massive quantity of evidence by the demolition of these two towers. He points out that Gage, he's an architect, points out that jet fuel burns at a maximum of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, while steel doesn't even begin to melt until about 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit, which is quite a 1,200-degree differential. But there's all sorts of other people that have jumped into this. Popular Mechanics has stepped in the fray, releasing a special report entitled Debunking the 9/11 Myths. Popular Mechanics says that plane debris sliced through the utility shafts at the North Tower's core, creating a conduit for burning jet fuel and fire destruction throughout the building. This assertion is countered by David Ray Griffin's book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking. So anyway, there's lots of, there's a real divide on this. And people on both sides, I should say all throughout the political spectrum, are very divided on this whole thing. And there's lots of people that think that conspiracies never happen. That life at the near top where, we expect conspiracies to operate is far too intricate and suitable for such shenanigans. Nicholas Lehman, writing on conspiracies last year for The New Yorker, claims conspiracy theories amount to, quote, a view of how the world works that mistakenly empowers particular and evil forces with the ability to determine the course of events, and it misses the messiness and contingency with which life actually unfolds. Well, if we bind Lehman's argument, then how about the Gulf of Tonkin after the explosion of the battleship Maine?
When the battleship got attacked by the rowboat.
What about Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Tuskegee medical experiments on unsuspecting, yes, African-American patients? And there's all sorts of numerous covert operations in foreign policy. And anyway, there's all sorts of other interesting things that have happened. Some were actually forced upon us, but we're seeing, take for example CIA's mind-altering Cold War era drug testing known as MK Ultra. Its scientists and hirelings dosed thousands of unwitting U.S. citizens with mind-altering drugs over the course of several decades. And perhaps the most revealing and lesser-known conspiracy in U.S. history was a stillborn 1933 business plot intended to overthrow the newly elected President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and put in place a fascist regime designed to, fronted by a retired Marine Corps Major General named Smedley Butler. Fortunately for us, the patriotic Butler spilled the beans. He even remembered what the recruiters said to him that wanted the coup. They said, quote, "You know the American people will swallow that. We've got the newspapers, and the dumb American people will fall for it in a second," Butler told the McCormick Diskin Committee, the first body convened by the House of Un-American Activities, by the way, on November 20th, 1934. Like most committees, Butler said after the report of the attempted coup was released that he made all this testimony to, it slaughtered the little and allowed the big to escape. The big shots weren't even called to testify. Some of the people that he named the conspirators who wanted to overthrow FDR and form a military government were J.P. Morgan, Irene DuPont, and an up-and-comer named Prescott Bush. So this is a very divisive issue here, and of course we've got Ed Vandell here that would like to add a few words.
Oh yeah, I was hearing about your suggestion that it may be a conspiracy or controlled explosions that knocked down the buildings, and I'd go offer another alternative explanation of why the buildings had collapsed. If you go to the World Trade Center site, there's like a giant base. A lot of those buildings were built on a giant base, on the same base. And when the first buildings collapsed, they undermined the foundation of the buildings that were not hit. Building number nine. Yeah. Or number seven. In fact, I forgot what it was. But anyway, I believe when the first buildings collapsed, they undermined the foundation of the other buildings. And that's the reason why they collapsed. It had to do with the fact that they were built on the same base.
What makes you think this, Ed? worst source of information on this?
Well, no. I mean, if you go to the site itself, you go to New York City, you see the entire old, you see a giant slab, the Fajajani Foundation, which is empty now, which they all built on the same foundation.
Okay, well, I mean, you know what? This would be something that a new investigation could probably look into.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible, but, you know, we'd never know unless there was another investigation enacted. So thanks for those point of view there. No problem. And we'd love to have commenters here on the Labor Hour, too, about any subject we're talking about. But in any case, yes, this is there's a lot that I think needs to be – there's a lot of things we don't know. I mean, a lot of things people assume – from what they've heard through the corporate media, and most of the corporate media sources came from the Bush administration.
A lot of things that the government absolutely does not want us to know.
Probably so, based on past experience with all sorts of affairs like the CIA coup in Chile that we talked about earlier, the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Practice in Guatemala.
Yeah, what this State Department of the U.S. government has done in the name with our tax money in the name of the American people. I don't know, but the point is that there's a lot of people calling for a new 9/11 investigation with a truly independent committee, and you can label, this is the whole thing here is why somebody would label anyone who wants to have a new investigation with a true independent panel conspiracy theorists, because frankly, I mean, this would be sort of the way to settle the question, or at least get some of the answers anyway. Probably wouldn't settle the question, but at least we'd get a lot more answers than what we've got from this Keene Hamilton official report that is just some of this stuff is unbelievable. But at any rate.
I'm sure something will pop in my head here. Hadn't yet.
In my line of work, you got a catapult to propaganda.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. Heck of a job.
You know, I just,
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees. Breach of the levees.
Maybe I'm not as quick on my feet as I should be.
You know, it's like they say, life imitates art. You remember being there?
Yeah,
Pete Bamford played a part. A retarded guy became the president. Yo, that was a movie. This is real. The ship we're on is sinking because there's a moron at the wheel. You pachyderms keep waving yellow flags and driving your big stupid Hummers. You thought what's-his-name was pretty dumb? This kid's a whole lot dumber.
You think? I'm sure historians will look back and say, gosh, you could have done it better this way or that way.
Oh, what a great time it is to be rich, stupid, and white!
Stupid!
Daddy says time to go back to Iraq and show them ragheads who's right.
Yo, boy wonder, best I can remember, Sodom had nothing to do with the World Trade Center.
What planet were you people on anyway? What the?
What you thinking? I mean, the guy opens his mouth and tries to speak. It's like a learning-impaired chimp that's been drinking.
Check this out.
The terriers and bears everywhere are torn down.
Wake up, dummies! You've been bushwhacked! You've been duped by Twit! But have no fear, the right wing's here!
If it's broke, can Halliburton fix it?
That'll cost you.
After work, he can call up Daddy and get some sage presidential advice. And then just for fun, hop on Air Force One and do some shopping with Condoleezza Rice.
Nice shoes. They could be hidden like the 50 tons of mustard gas in a turkey farm.
Don't go blaming the president. What's the matter with you? He didn't tap any phones. Rush said so. It's gotta be true. Yeah, well, that oxy popping whale ought to be down by law, spewing his rhetoric about Daddy like he's Quick Draw McGraw.
Come on, a monkey only moves fast when he's sneaking off on another vacation.
That's usually when there's a serious crisis about to affect the nation.
No, I don't want to sound like I've made no mistakes. I'm confident I have.
Wake up, dummies! You've been bushwhacked! You've been conned by a fool! And if the Trump family wasn't richer than God, little George would still be in high school. And all you self-righteous hypocrites who would have hanged Bill Clinton for getting a little on the side, let me tell you something. Last time I checked, extramarital sex wasn't quite as bad as genocide.
Genocide. Genocide.
Poor people aren't necessarily killers.
Okay, that was Bushwhacked by popular demand. We got a lot of comments on that song. We've played it a couple times over the air. Quite appropriate, in my opinion. I think
very
we got a few
lightning song.
Yes, we got a few public service announcements. First one is an international public service announcement, so to speak. On August 24, 2008, the General Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq called for a mass demonstration against the recent decree issued by the Minister of Finance in which he ordered a significant reduction in wages and benefits for workers. Government officials asked the workers to send their representatives for negotiations with the minister's representative, Sabi Abadi, president of the GFWCUI. was elected to head a delegation of labor leaders to represent workers who took to the streets in the thousands. After the meeting, Al-Adabri was stopped at the exit door of the ministry by a number of guards who belonged to the Badr militia. The guards confiscated his personal belongings, beat him up, and attempted a kidnapping. The kidnap attempt was throttled by other workers. The guards, however, shot at Brother Subi, who miraculously escaped the bullets. Later on the same day, the guards called Saeed Nima, vice president of the GFWCI, and vowed to kill President Al-Badri whenever and wherever they find him. Please take a few minutes to send a message to the Iraqi ambassador to the U.S. and the chief of the Iraqi mission to the United Nations to express your outrage. Demand that the Iraqi government assure the safety of trade unionists to their union rights of organizing and collective bargaining.
I'd like to remind folks that Unity March 5 is coming up on October the 4th, a Saturday. The theme this year is the township faces the many faces of poverty. The march will begin from the Champaign Township office, which is at Randolph and Green, and will conclude at Douglas Park. And march will conclude with a reception and a rally. There are a number of local organizations supporting it, like AWARE, CU Citizens Peace for Justice, and several more here that I don't really have time to read. But at Saturday, October 4th, 2008, march begins at 11 a.m. at the Champaign Township office.
And last but not least, Dan Kenny, a historian and member of Clearwater, the antagonist to Blackwater, talk about privatization, outsourcing, and sovereignty in our rights. On Friday, October 10th, he'll be speaking at noon to 2 in 123 English Building on campus, sponsored by the History Discussion Group. And that's all. We ran out of time. And thank you for tuning in to the Illinois World Labor Hour.